President Obama takes executive action on immigration. Hello and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. We discuss the week that was and dig behind the news and newsmakers making headlines. Almost 2 years after launching his push to reform immigration, President Obama acts this week, but without the approval from Congress. How could the plan affect Florida? Gun violence on campus at Florida State University. 3 students are injured by a gunman who was killed by police. The cost to fix up Marine Stadium may be more expensive than anticipated if the plan survives at all. But the Marlins can afford the richest contract in Major League Baseball history. It's all ahead on the Florida Roundup, next on WLRN. Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Almost 2 years after launching his push to reform immigration, and 2 weeks after his party suffered a bad election loss, President Obama is going it alone on immigration.
And to those members of Congress who question my authority to make our immigration system work better, or question the wisdom of me acting where Congress has failed, I have one answer. Pass a bill.
President Obama this week using his executive powers to stop up to 5 million immigrants from being deported. For an undocumented immigrant, if they've been living in the United States for more than 5 years, have children who are citizens or legal residents, register with the government, pass a criminal background check, and pay taxes, the president's action would allow them to stay temporarily without the threat of being deported. The president cautions not to call it amnesty.
This deal does not apply to anyone who has come to this country recently. It does not apply to anyone who might come to America illegally in the future. It does not grant citizenship or the right to stay here permanently or offer the same benefits that citizens receive. Only Congress can do that. All we're saying is we're not going to deport you.
This morning, House Speaker John Boehner took to the microphones saying that the president is, quote, acting like a king. Speaker Boehner saying, quote, we will not stand idly by as the president undermines the rule of law and places lives at risk, end quote. Florida Republican Senator Mario Rubio released a statement calling the president's actions, quote, unfair to people in our immigration system who are doing things the right way, end quote. Maria Villalba came to the U.S. 15 years ago from Argentina. She lives in South Florida. She'll be able to stay thanks to her son's permanent resident status.
It's going to be so different. I'm not going to be living in fear. That is the concept. Because I'm always thinking that something could happen to me and be deported.
Sandra Biso also came to the U.S. from Argentina more than a decade ago, but she does not qualify to temporarily avoid the threat of deportation.
Yo esperaba que nos diera a los padres también el beneficio para poder estar tranquilos junto a nuestros hijos, que yo tengo dos dreamers.
She says she was hoping for President Obama to give parents of dreamers peace along with their children, because she has 2 children who are dreamers, student immigrants who are allowed to be here because of deferred action. Now she says she plans to keep hiding.
Undocumented immigrant Sandra Biso speaking with WLRN's Jessica Mazeros. So do you support President Obama's executive action that he took this week? Do you support the process, the executive action, instead of fighting it out in Congress? Are you an undocumented immigrant qualifying for the president's plan? Are you the son or daughter of someone who does? Let us know. Join the conversation here on the Florida Roundup at 1-800-743-WLRN. 1-800-743-9576. Online at WLRN.org for our live web chat, or on Twitter, use the handle at WLRN. Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us at WLRN. Matt Laszlo joining us from Washington, D.C., where he covers Capitol Hill for us here in South Florida. Tim, let's begin right here in South Florida. What kind of impact could these executive actions have on immigrants calling South Florida home?
Well, a much more of an impact that it would have had a decade ago. As you and I both know, a decade ago, when it came to immigration, this was still pretty much a non-issue because immigrant meant Cuban.
Right.
That has changed dramatically over the past decade. I mean, Mexicans alone, who used to be, you know, just small clusters of agricultural workers in the Redlands, are today a much larger and much more fixed community. They've seen 40% growth of their population over the past decade. So we now have immigrants in South Florida who, for the first time in the history of this community, really care about this issue. So the impact is big.
And the impact on Capitol Hill, Matt Laszlo, we heard from Speaker Boehner essentially calling the president's action king-like. This lands with a thud on Capitol Hill, doesn't it?
Yeah, Republicans are furious, and they say this just continues a trend from the White House to just bypass Congress, which the president admittedly is bypassing Congress on this, but he's also saying, Congress, come to the table and work with me. But Republicans are saying, no, he's already soured the water. So now there's a real threat of a government shutdown. Some rank-and-file House Republicans are saying they don't want to send the White House money for immigration enforcement because the president isn't using it. So we'll see. Things are going to get pretty heated up here yet again.
Yeah, let's tackle the politics of this first before we do tackle the policy, and we will. Tim Padgett, speak to that. I mean, the president acted and essentially all but said to Congress, I'm doing this, pass a bill. If you don't want me to do any kind of action here that we're taking tonight, pass a bill, send it our way.
Right. And as the Republicans sit down now and figure out a strategy, a way to react to this, I think there are two numbers that they have to think about between now and 2016, the presidential election, and that's 71 and 27. Obama in 2012 got 71% of the Latino vote. It was phenomenal. Republicans, Mitt Romney, got a paltry 27% of the vote. Latinos are still, you know, even though their voter performance was not that stellar in these recent midterms, they do come out to vote in presidential elections. And if Democrats are still able to pick up those kinds of numbers in 2016, Republicans are in trouble.
Matt Laszlo from Washington, this is not just a border state issue into the next election cycle. This goes right into the heartland of America. So how does a congressional delegation like that which South Florida sends to Congress wind up kind of trying to treat the politics of this as you look at the 535 members of Capitol Hill?
Well, South Florida is really interesting because there we have three now with Mr. Cabela joining Ileana Ross-Layton and Mario Diaz-Balart. There's three South Florida Republicans who are advocating, vocal advocates for immigration reform. But they're also not the biggest fans of President Obama. So speaking with Mr. Diaz-Balart this week, he was, you know, furious. Even before we heard the announcement, he was furious, saying that the president was going back on his word, that he had already said he couldn't do this. And Mr. Diaz-Balart was saying, you know what? I probably agree with his action or agree with his intent that he wants to keep these people here in the U.S., but he says he doesn't like the way he's going about it. So you could kind of see Mr. Diaz-Balart putting himself into a little bit of a pretzel because he likes the policy on the one hand. He's just not happy with President Obama, and he doesn't like that he's bypassing Republicans. And Mr. Diaz-Balart is a voice within the Republican caucus advocating for reform. And so he says he just isn't going to be listened to by other Republicans and won't have the leverage he had without the president acting.
The real fine line here, Tim, is that policy versus process.
Right.
And especially for that South Florida delegation back up into Washington.
This is a big moment, really, for the South Florida congressional delegation because, as Matt was pointing out, for years now, Ileana, Mario, and Joe Garcia, who is now being replaced by Mr. Curbelo, they have been advocates for immigration reform because they have had to walk a fine line between protecting the special immigration privileges that Cuban immigrants get, but yet still make it look like they are sympathetic to what groups like Mexicans and Haitians need. So they have been really out on the forefront in the Republican Party in terms of advocating immigration reform, and the Republican Party is going to need that kind of leadership from them between now and 2016 as they figure out how to react to this.
That's Tim Padgett covering the Americas for us here on WLRN. Matt Laszlo joining us from Washington, D.C. Your turn here at 1-800-743-9576. On the Florida Roundup at 1-800-743-WLRN, online, WLRN.org, or on Twitter, at WLRN. Maria is joining us via the phone from Miami. Maria, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to share a little bit of my experience. Immigration reform is something that I'm really passionate about. I immigrated here when I was 5 years old. I've been in the country 24 years.
Okay. So you came after 1981, which is the date that is spelled out in the Deferred Action Act.
Yes. You know, my family lived in the shadows for a really long time. I was able to go, you know, get through high school, and I graduated with honors and a partial scholarship to school, but I couldn't go because I didn't have a social security number and I wasn't eligible for financial aid. And, you know, eventually I got my life together, but, you know, I've met other kids along the way who are going through the same thing. And I'm just so, glad that they'll, you know, be able to have a chance to become, you know, go to school and become, productive members of society and vote, because I think at the end of the day, you know, it's a real threat to the Republicans that these people stand to become, you know, legal voting citizens, you know, that...
Where did your family come from, Maria?
We came from Uruguay.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
South America. Yeah.
And, you know, I remember as a kid, when I got here, there weren't many of us, and now there's a huge Uruguayan and Argentinian community here in South Florida.
Maria, we appreciate the phone call, and thanks for sharing your personal experience with us. Maria's experience coming as a 5-year-old 24 years ago from Uruguay speaks to that great diversity of immigration that continues to grow here in South Florida. WLRN's Christy Mate is along with us from the Guatemalan Maya Center in Lake Worth. Chris, just wrapping up a press conference. What's the reaction to the president's immigration executive action from the Guatemalan Mayan Center?
Well, first, Tom, the Guatemalan Mayan Center is a bit of a misnomer because over the years it's expanded to include more people than just the indigenous Indian population of Guatemala. It serves Mexican people, Guatemalans, people from El Salvador. But in answer to your question, a lot of applause this morning here, also a lot of tears, because there, unfortunately, are people to whom the president's action does not apply to.
Tell us a little bit about that, about what those folks that the policy would not capture and have the temporary threat of deportation lifted.
Well, there was one lady that we spoke to, Tom, named Rosa, and I think she is a perfect illustration of one example of, you know, an example of one person that this policy does not apply to. Rosa is 47 years old. She's a farm worker. She has grown children, but they're in Honduras. So she has no children here who are U.S. citizens or legal residents. Okay, and because of that, the chances are that she is not going to qualify for this action that the president spoke about yesterday. So we spoke to her, and she still lives with the same fear of deportation that she had yesterday. She was in tears, and we asked her how she felt, and she just kept repeating over and over again, "Tengo miedo, tengo miedo, I'm afraid, I'm afraid."
Does Rosa plan on staying in the United States?
Yes, absolutely. And she just kept saying in Spanish, por favor, no Guatemala. I don't want to go back. I don't want to go back. She said she was fleeing violence. The reason that she fled was she was being forced by her father into an arranged marriage. The man that she was with in Guatemala actually abused her very, very badly. She showed me her scars. And she said that the conditions are just awful there. And then she just burst into tears again, and she said, I'm not going back. So in answer to your question, she has every intention of staying, but there's that fear always that she's going to be deported.
Christine DiMatte from the Guatemalan Maya Center in Lake Worth. As South Floridians react to President Obama's executive action announced late yesterday in regards to immigration. And Tim Padgett, what Chris captured there with the 47-year-old agriculture worker Rosa is there is many immigrants that are going to fall outside this executive action because it's really geared toward families, toward the parents of kids that are citizens or legal residents.
Well, one of the things Obama emphasized last night was that our immigration system is broken, but I think his executive action itself also shows how disjointed our approach to immigration can be. I mean, on the one hand, for example, you have this woman, Rosa, who has been here for so long that she has probably established herself in the community, pays taxes, you know, is sort of probably the person that we would want to stay here as an immigrant. On the other hand, hand, you've got the Dreamers who thought their parents were going to be included in this gesture, and they weren't. So you have two instances there where that really don't seem to make a lot of sense to people, and I think that's very illustrative of just how ad hoc and, as I said, disjointed our approach to immigration can be in this country.
Yeah, and Matt Laszlo, Washington, D.C., immigration is complex, it's nuanced, and we're hearing it here the day after this executive action announced, and you're hearing, obviously, lots of resistance from Republicans talking about the possibility of a lawsuit to a government shutdown to defunding certain programs as a reaction. But where does the debate, where does the immigration policy debate go from here? In this lame duck Congress, as we look to gavel in a new Congress in early January, what's the setup? Is there an environment for congressional action now?
Well, this is the interesting thing. Remember, the Senate passed it. Democrats controlled the Senate in January. They won't pass it. The Senate passed it with overwhelming margins. I think they still have the numbers to pass something like what they passed last time. It would probably need some more border security and things like that, red meat for the Republican base. But the question is the House. The House, remember, they promised they were going to do something. They didn't really do anything. They did something on high-skilled visas, and I don't even think they took up a bill on border security. It worked through committee, but I don't think it passed. So now some voices in the Republican Party are saying, hey, we have to do something. So they're going to do the low-hanging fruit, high-skilled visas. They're going to do the low-hanging fruit of more border security.
Yeah.
And they're just going to start picking at the edges. The question becomes, especially for South Florida Republicans, can they get anything looking like a pathway to citizenship? Can they get a big deal? Because without that, Democrats aren't going to come to the table. And the White House, while it supports high-skilled visas and tweaking that and bringing more of those here, and while it supports or could support some more border security, they say no. Unless we deal with the 11 million undocumented workers here, we just can't deal.
And they have to do that because, you know, high-skilled worker visas, that is important. But that matters a lot more to European, Asian immigrants. It doesn't matter to the, for example, the Mexican-American population that much, that makes up two-thirds of the Latino population in this country, but isn't as concerned about the high-skilled visa. What they're more concerned about, for example, is a more comprehensive and sensical guest worker program that has to be addressed in that third component of what Obama talked about last night.
The other two components being border security and high-skilled visas that the president announced with his executive action. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN on Twitter at WLRN. Scott joins the program from Miami. Scott, go ahead. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I just want to express how sick I am of all our elected representatives just serving their own political interests rather than serving the public interest. The Republicans are complaining that now the well is poisoned and so they're not going to act. But they know full well that the executive order is temporary, and they can nullify it tomorrow if they wanted to. But they don't want to. So they love having an excuse to continue to obstruct instead of act. And the president's guilty of this, too. His timing, I'm sure, is at least in part motivated by an effort to bait the Republicans into embarrassing themselves with more brinkmanship. And I just wish that these people would act in the public interest instead of just always looking out for their own political self-interest.
Scott joining the conversation from Miami. Thanks for your thoughts there, Scott. Matt Laszlo in Washington. Let's tackle Senator Rubio here. He was out front on immigration a few years ago. He was among the group of eight senators that was negotiating a comprehensive immigration reform bill in the United States Senate. Of course, the fate of that bill, we now well know, was to go nowhere. And Senator Rubio, even prior to the president's official beginning time yesterday at 8 o'clock Eastern, sent out a statement calling the president's action unfair to people in the immigration system doing the right things.
Yeah, Senator Rubio, he's interesting on this. And he makes my head spin on this a little bit. And I
How
think
so?
Anyone would say that. Because he voted for it. He crafted the deal that the Senate passed last year, and then conservative talk radio hosts started complaining about it, House Republicans started complaining about it, and he walked himself back and kind of distanced himself from the deal he crafted. So I don't know where Senator Rubio is on this, but one might wonder, I don't know if I'm as cynical as that last maybe a little bit, but one wonders if he's just eyeing the White House in 2016 Laszlo, as opposed to his own policy.
Laszlo's joining us via Skype from Washington, so the connection there breaking up a little bit. But, you know, Scott, the previous caller, talking about sick of the political calculations when it comes to immigration, but you can't avoid them.
No, and Marco Rubio is paying now on immigration for a political calculation he made back in 2010 when he sort of got a little too cozy, perhaps, with the Tea Party. And when he did put himself out in front on immigration, I mean, let's remember, I mean, he was really the guy the Republicans were looking for when he became a senator to be the bridge between Republicans and Latinos. He even came out and equated the experience of Mexican migrants with the experience of Cuban exiles, et cetera. I mean, there was a lot of forward-thinking stuff that he was coming up with. But then all of a sudden, he went a little too far in advocating immigration reform for the Tea Party, and it came back to bite him. And now he finds himself, I think, a little bit, as Matt was, I think, inferring, a little bit too much on the sidelines now on immigration policy.
This is the Florida Roundup. That's Tim Padgett with WLRN. Matt Laszlo joining us from Washington, D.C. You can join the conversation at 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Bob is joining the program from Fort Lauderdale. Bob, welcome in.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Doing well. Go ahead.
I just want to make a quick comment regarding the story about the immigrant worker, Rosa.
Yes.
My comment is this. I do understand that she doesn't want to go back, and I do understand why she does not want to go back. But I would imagine that if she wanted to stay in America and be in America, number one, that she would do some of the little things, like perhaps learn how to speak English. The interview that she did with Ms. DiMatte was she was speaking in Spanish. And, you know, do the little things. A comment that one of the gentlemen had made a few moments ago regarding her story was that she probably pays taxes. If she's an immigrant, illegal immigrant, or undocumented alien, as is politically correct to say, she would probably not have a Social Security number. If you don't have a Social Security number, I don't really understand how you can pay taxes.
No, they actually do. Many undocumented immigrants do find ways within their communities. You know, these are tight-knit communities, and they come up with all sorts of ways to, you know, to sort of help themselves, bond into the larger community better. So you do find a lot of undocumented immigrants who do pay taxes. I know that community up there in Lake Worth very well, and these are people who, you know, who have businesses. I know that one woman, for example, who's a taxi driver. She's undocumented, but she tells me that she has found a way to pay taxes.
But Bob, we hear you. Thanks for your thoughts from Fort Lauderdale here today regarding Rosa, the Guatemalan woman who's been in South Florida for many, many years as an agriculture worker. Rosa's case, though, is illustrative, Tim, of each immigrant has his or her own story. Sure. And in the case of Rosa running away from a violent place, running away from a violent relationship, as she told WLRN's Christine DiMatte, running away from a country that is seeped in violence, seeking refugee, not only, you know, in this case, you know, safety, personal safety, and economic refugee.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, in her case, as in the case of a lot of people up in that community, I think that, you know, they are probably applying for, you know, asylum as much as they might be applying for, you know, legalized status. But Bob does make a good point that, you know, we used to complain in Miami about, you know, the Cuban exiles not learning English and just sort of stay. And I think we do need to expect those little things, as Bob said, from other immigrant groups as well.
Lydia is going to join the Florida Roundup here from Miami. Lydia, go ahead. Welcome to the program. Lydia, are you with us?
Yes.
Go ahead with your thoughts on the program on immigration.
Okay. What I tell her already? What my thoughts? You want me to tell you again?
Lydia, go ahead. You're live on the radio.
Okay. I'm Lydia. I'm Cuban. I came in 1962. I married here. My children and my grandchildren were born here. We are very proud to be here in this country. We are American. I'm a citizen, and of course, my children. Now, what's the matter with all the Latino people, the one who came and worked hard, who wants to be in this country? Why Senator Rubio forgot that he is Cuban and his parents came because they want to live better? Why Ross Lehtinen and Diaz-Balart forget that they are Cubans? They only want to have the position. They don't care about people. Why they don't get together, Republicans and Democrats, and get something done for the immigration? Fix it.
Lydia,
do something for those people, please.
Lydia, you can hear the passion in your voice. You support the president's executive actions that he took yesterday.
Yes, I do. And he has to keep going. And those people, the Republican people, they have to realize that this is a country for people, not for a group of us.
Lydia,
for a group of them.
Lydia from Miami, coming to South Florida from Cuba in 1962, joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Matt Laszlo, Lydia voices that kind of connection here that the South Florida delegation is going to be faced with as we move into the new congressional cycle, and how they are able to kind of find that balance, especially on the Republican side, of policy, of immigration policy that their constituents are asking about, and the process that the party may not necessarily favor on Capitol Hill of what the president has done.
Yeah, and it becomes really interesting, that passion we heard from Lydia. A lot of people who are up for election, a lot of lawmakers coming into the 114th Congress next year, they didn't feel that passion on the campaign trail. A lot of Latino voters sat this election out because they were frustrated with the White House for not acting.
Yeah.
2016 is going to be very different.
Yep.
And Democrats right now are really, really threatening that the Latino voice is going to come out in numbers, and that it's going to be for Democrats, not for Republicans.
And listen, it wasn't just Latino voters sitting out the midterm elections. This executive action on immigration, which has been pledged by this White House for at least 2 years, arguably back to the first Obama administration, the four traditional national broadcast television networks sat out this presidential address from the White House as well. NBC had The Biggest Loser on last night. CBS, it was The Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
Grey's Anatomy was on ABC, and it was Bones on Fox. The president of the United States could not crack prime time on over-the-air network television, Tim.
Yeah, and again, and this is another a warning, I think, for the Republicans. I think that indicates to you that it's going to be hard for them to work up a passion about this issue from non-Latino voters. And so, I don't know how, really how much legs this has as an issue for them, as they move forward to fight him on the executive action, because I don't think, maybe their base, but beyond their base, non-Latino voters, I don't think, are going to muster the passion for this that I think Republicans hope.
Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us here at WLRN. Matt Laszlo covers Capitol Hill for us here at WLRN, joining us from Washington, D.C. Thanks to both you gentlemen. Still to come on the Florida Roundup, the paper and pencils will be back for some public school test takers in Florida. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Nathan Scott found himself at the Strozier Library on campus at Florida State University just after midnight early Thursday morning. He was one of three students shot by FSU alum Myron May. May opened fire outside the library before getting into the front lobby of the building, getting off more than 30 bullets with Tallahassee police, who shot and killed him. May shot at Jason Durfus, but the books in his backpack stopped the bullets. He later found the bullet in his backpack. He spoke with the newspaper, the Tallahassee Democrat.
I was walking down the steps of Strozier when I heard a loud bang behind me. And this bang was definitely a gunshot. I turned around very slowly and saw the gunman take two more shots at another person. And that's when I ran for my life.
Classes resumed at FSU one day after the shooting as investigators continue to learn more about the gunman. Kathleen McGrory covers the Capitol for the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times. John O'Connor covering state education policy here with us at WLRN and State Impact. Kat, any update on the condition of the shooting victims on Friday?
Unfortunately, there was no update this morning. We know that one of the victims, who has been identified only as a male student, is still in the hospital in critical condition, but there's not all that much that we know.
On the investigation side, police pretty early on called this an isolated incident, and that continues to be their line of inquiry here, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It was isolated because the shooter was later shot dead by police.
And it all came about pretty quickly. It was right around 12:30 or so, according to the timeline, that this Myron May kind of walked up to the library outside and got off a couple of shots. I think within moments, police were there, and within 2 minutes of their arrival, the gunman had been shot and killed.
Yeah, it all happened very quickly. It sounds like he went into the library first and fired a couple rounds, and then police are saying he left the library on his own, and that's where they had the later shooting between the police and the shooter.
Yeah, it's important to note here, John O'Connor, he never got inside the library proper, per se. It sounds like the security measures, for whatever reason, may have worked in this case, preventing further carnage.
Right, yeah. That does sound like it's been the case here, and that the quick response from police kind of kept this thing from being worse than it was.
Yeah. Kat, what have we learned about the shooter here in the last 24, 36 hours?
Well, we know that he's a 2005 graduate of Florida State, so this was a homecoming for him. He was born in Florida, had left to go to Texas to pursue a law degree and to practice law, and had recently come back to Florida, to a small town in the Panhandle, which is where he was born.
Mm-hmm.
We do know he had a history of some mental health issues. There had been some issues in New Mexico, where he had also lived for a while, with some interesting interactions he had with police there. But folks seemed pretty surprised that that this guy, that May, would, you know, resort to such actions. They said, at FSU, he was a pretty reserved, modest guy who was ambitious, and they would have never expected this from him.
Yeah, a tragedy all around here as that investigation continues. The relatively new president at Florida State University, John Thrasher, just took hold of that administration just a matter of weeks ago, John, right?
Yeah. He was just approved by the State Board of Governors.
Yeah, just recently. And he'd been really kind of wrestling with more poor public relations in regards to some New York Times reporting about alleged preferential treatment of student athletes at FSU. And then this tragedy came along.
Yeah, he, I mean, obviously he was...
the mic volume.
He was chosen for the...
The mic volume up.
Chosen for the position. It was controversial. The students kind of opposed him. There were some faculty that opposed him as well. So he steps into the job under those circumstances as well. Then he has what's going on with the athletic program, which obviously predates him.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, you know, within his first month of taking the job, he has to deal with this incident and whatever kind of follows from it.
Yeah. Kat McGraw, are you still with us in Tallahassee?
Yes, I am.
Class is back in session here on Friday. We know there was a candlelight ceremony on Thursday night, less than a day after the shootings. Any special programs, any special concerns as we move into a holiday week and, of course, finals week in the weeks ahead at FSU?
Yeah, there was a candlelight vigil last night. It was a very emotional event. It was attended by more than 1,000 students. The marching band was there. There were a cappella performances. And the new president, President Thrasher, gave a pretty moving speech about how everybody ought to come together as Seminoles. There were other programs going on during the day. The counseling center was providing lots of services. There was a town hall that offered students strategies on how they might cope. There were therapy dogs on campus. But yes, classes have resumed today. The library is open, and Thrasher made it very clear that he wants a return to normalcy.
Kathleen McGrory from the Miami Herald, Tampa Bay Times with us from Tallahassee. John O'Connor covering state education policy for us here at WLRN. Let's go from higher education to primary education. 4th through 7th graders in public schools here in the Sunshine State will use paper and pencil after all, not computers or tablets, to take the state's new standardized writing test this coming spring. The State Department of Education making that change this week over worries that young students won't have developed the typing skills necessary to write on a keyboard. John, you've been looking into this test that's replacing FCAT, the Florida Standards Assessment is what it's called. Testing begins March 1st. What are the technology requirements for this test, first of all?
Well, it's an online test, and you know, that sounds like a big change, but Florida is one of the largest states in terms of already using online tests with the FCAT. So there'll be about 4 million students taking tests online this year, the department estimates. The test is more interactive. It's got questions that kind of require students to perform little tasks, to manipulate things on the computer in order to get it done. This change in terms of the writing test, where 4th through 7th graders will take it on pencil and paper, this was always a possibility. Mm-hmm. One of the key factors in the companies that the Florida Department of Education asked for, and companies that were bidding on the contract, was you need to be able to provide us with a paper and pencil option if possible. So there were some concerns from the state superintendents about this, and the Department of Education said, okay, this year the writing test for 4th through 7th graders will be paper and pencil, but next year it's going to go to the computer. And Pam Stewart, the education commissioner, made it pretty clear that she's not all that worried about these concerns about kids taking tests on computers, because she felt like, you know, being able to use a computer is a skill they're going to need as well as being able to write.
It certainly is, but those keyboard skills for 10, 11, 12-year-olds may be a lot different than 17 and 18-year-olds. If you're a parent, let us know what your thoughts on this Florida Standards Assessment replacing FCAT and keyboard skills of your youngster, or perhaps you yourself are looking forward to these tests here in the springtime. Here on the Florida Roundup, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Pam Stewart, the education secretary, says, John, that she is confident in technology, but we've heard other stories from superintendents concerned about not only the number of computers that are available, but also just how robust the connectivity is, how robust the internet connections are at these schools.
Yeah, this has been something that's been ongoing. The big districts seem to be okay, and they say that they seem to be okay. Their main problem or main concern is just having enough computers to test all the kids. Other districts, more rural districts, are worried about the connection, about whether they'll have enough, you know, internet bandwidth to handle the capacity of all of this testing. The other issue that you're hearing from a lot of schools is that because all these tests are online, and if they don't have enough machines, they're essentially going to have to kind of shut off computer labs from students for reasons other than testing for long periods of time.
The critics will also point out, listen, this focus on online testing and typing skills means that the students ultimately are going to be judged on their keyboard skills, not their composition or their ability to comprehend a text.
That's true, but it's also important to note that the ability to type is something that's in the standard. So this is something that will be expected of students anyway.
And the standard is the state standard, Sunshine State Standards.
Yes, the state standards, you know, so both handwriting is in there, but also typing as well.
Meantime, you've got the Miami-Dade school superintendent, Alberto Carvalho, who's been a vocal critic of high-stakes testing, going so far as asking for a timeout of state-mandated tests. And the superintendent found an ally this week in ninth grader Justin Grandados. He found this ally at the monthly school board meeting here in Miami.
Ever since the third grade, I failed every FCAT, math, reading, even science when I got it in eighth grade. The only thing I ever did pass was the writing, and it makes me scared and kind of like nervous, and also in a way it makes me not want to take the test, because the test made me feel as if this is the do or die, and I didn't study all year just to take a test says that I'm doing wrong and I should stay back a grade.
Now, he's referring there, of course, to the FCAT, which he's taken in years past. He said he has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, skipped school the day that the test was taken in the sixth grade to avoid taking it. He failed the sixth grade, but he was able to advance to the seventh grade thanks to special classes. Here's Superintendent Carvalho at the meeting.
This is a case which unfortunately is not unique, where sometimes the child is not broken, but the systems around children certainly can break their spirits and their hearts. And we have a collective obligation of doing something really big about it. So I made a personal vow to Justin that he's not going to be a statistic.
We've seen Superintendent Carvalho, we've seen entire school boards in the case of Lee County push against more testing. Are we experiencing, John O'Connor, this power shift away from Tallahassee on state education policy into local districts?
Maybe just a little bit. The types of people who are talking about changing the testing regulations in the state are important, because we have state legislative leaders talking about it now. In the past, those folks would have tended to brush off these concerns from parents, from school boards, as folks who were maybe looking to duck the consequences of, you know, not doing their job as well as they should. So the fact that, and this is happening across the country, it's not just Florida. So there's definitely been kind of a change in the view of the amount of testing and how it should be applied.
What's at risk for these local school districts? When Lee County over in the Southwest Florida area rejected state testing and then repealed that rejection, you know, the state Department of Education came out with a long list of problems, including your students may not be qualified to graduate if you don't take these tests.
Yeah, that's the kind of one that really gets parents in a panic.
Right.
The big hammer, though, is money. You know, the State Department of Education can withhold funding to the district to such an extent that the district wouldn't be able to operate without it. So, you know, they could shut down the school district if they wanted to by withholding the funding. So that's really what's at stake. And then you have all these other consequences of students moving on from one grade to the next or graduating or whatever.
Let's bring it back to that test, that Florida State Standards Assessment Test beginning March 1st. Public school kids throughout the Sunshine State and here in South Florida will be taking it. You've been looking at this test. You'll have a full report Monday here on WLRN. What strikes you initially about what's going to be different?
Well, the first thing that strikes me is it's hard. You know, I was looking at the math questions particularly. I mean, I got elementary school math questions. I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that's not bad. And then I got to middle school math questions and like, oh, man. There's a lot of kind of around-the-way reasoning. You know, so they give you the problem. They give you holes in the middle of the problem, and you got to fill in the holes in the middle of the problem rather than giving you the entire problem and asking for the answer.
Are these word problems or digit problems?
To a degree, yeah. Some of them are word problems. Some of them are digit problems. Some of them are graphical kinds of problems, like there's Venn diagrams and things like that. It's going to be challenging. We've heard that on the national Common Core Tide tests that are being developed, that they expect less than half of students will be quote unquote proficient, you know, at grade level on these
tests. How's that compare to the FCAT last year?
Well, I mean,
would that be a significant drop?
Yeah, you're talking a 30 percentage point drop, wow. Probably maybe 40 percentage point drop, depending on what the results are.
And so when the superintendent here at Miami-Dade calls it high stakes testing, if you see that kind of drop off in assessments with the new Florida State standards, is money at risk? Are teacher raises at risk? Are school grades at risk?
Not necessarily. Part of this process is that they're going to recalibrate the school grading scale based on the results of these new tests. So next spring we'll get the results, and they'll kind of break down the results so that the results on the new test and the new grading scale kind of matches. You know, the top 20% of kids are here, bottom 20% of kids are here, and then they'll reset the scale based on that.
I'm going to have you bone up on your algebra over the weekend, O'Connor, all right? John O'Connor covering state education policy with us here at WLRN. Kathleen McGrory with us earlier from the Miami Herald, Tampa Bay Times from Tallahassee. Still to come here on the Florida Roundup, the mess over the Miami Marine Stadium, and the Marlins signed the richest contract in Major League Baseball history. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. It was supposed to be the start of breathing new life into a forgotten but iconic building in South Florida, the Miami Marine Stadium. Instead, the deal fell apart on Thursday in front of the Miami City Commission. David Smiley covers the city of Miami for the Miami Herald and is with us here on the Florida Roundup. David, what happened? This deal a week ago, the Miami Boat Show International was coming to the Marine Stadium for a couple of years. It seemed like this was finally going to breathe new life into this area.
Right. They had this celebratory press conference at the stadium with the boat show, with Mayor Tomas Regalado, with Gloria Estefan, announcing that the boat show was going to come to the stadium as an anchor tenant, and that they were going to go this week to the commission sort of for the authorization to have formal negotiations. And I think that the thing is that the deal was never really on that firm of standing. At the time of the press conference, the commissioners who had to vote to approve this thing didn't really have the details of the agreement. And when they came out, it wasn't just a $30 million renovation and restoration of the stadium. It was a $121 million redevelopment deal that would include the restoration of the stadium, but also would include the construction of a marine expo center, of dry boat storage, and of a park, sort of a multi-use park that was, you know, crucial to hosting the boat show. And the majority of this was going to be financed by this private partnership, of which no one really seemed to know it was coming.
Much bigger deal than originally originally thought,
right,
once you saw the documents. And while the group involved here, Friends of the Miami Marine Stadium, had pledged no public money, which didn't seem to be a problem in the environment that we're in post Marlins Park construction, of course, once the details or transparency began to see who were some of the players here, there were some concerns about who had skin in the game and who didn't.
Right, right. I should say that years ago, there was an understanding that there would be other private uses around the stadium.
So this is all predicated, of course, that the stadium would be a municipal stadium. It would be a lease to Friends of Miami Marine Stadium, mm-hmm, for public uses and allow some private usage as,
right,
well.
Right. But when the corporate sponsors became known, I think the public and commissioners started sort of wondering, well, you know, we haven't really talked to these people. This is a fairly large deal, for public land. And the deal to avoid going to a referendum and a bidding process, it was crucial that it was with a not-for-profit. And then all of a sudden you have a not-for-profit almost being a minority player in a very large project. But I think, you know, while there have been problems with members of that financing team, I think maybe a little too much has been made of that. I think really in the end, the deal was shaky from the get-go because of the numbers in the financing, and the administration never seemed to feel comfortable with the revenue projections and how they were going to make this deal work over 98 years.
I think some of the concerns that you wrote in your piece, rosy financial projections.
Right.
What happens now? Is the deal dead, or is there some kind of smaller, shorter term lease arrangement that could again get activity back to Marine Stadium?
Right. Well, that deal, the Friends of Miami Marine Stadium deal, with TPA Group out of Atlanta and Expo Miami out of
those
Miami,
are the for-profit partners in this.
Right. That deal is dead. Now the Miami Commission is going to enter into direct negotiations with the Miami International Boat Show to try and keep them at the site. And it looks like Miami is going to consider public financing for at least the stadium, the renovation of the stadium grounds to keep the boat show. They need about $15 million or so in improvements for the sort of flex space park, which has to be wired with utilities and have all these improvements in order to host the show by February 2016. So the city of Miami now looks like they'll be perhaps publicly financing that, where that was really a no-no a couple of years ago.
Absolutely. David Smiley covering the Miami Marine Stadium situation for the Miami Herald. And of course, it was a no-no because of Marlins Park and what happened there. Well, Miami can now claim, in fact, to be the home of the richest contract in Major League Baseball. $325 million over 13 years. Giancarlo Stanton, 25 years old, an outfielder, runner-up for the National League Most Valuable Player. Auto dealer Norman Brayman, very vocal critic of the public help to have Marlins build Marlins Park with the public financing. His outcry and the financial support helped lead, of course, to a election recall. This week, with the Marlins signing of this huge contract, Brayman was not critical of the Marlins owner or the Marlins president.
I've never had a problem with Jeffrey Loria or with David Sampson. I mean, the two of them have done what sports owners do throughout this country. What Steve Ross just did in working his deal with the county. And you look at Minneapolis, you look at Chicago, you look at all these places, whether it's football, whether it's baseball. This is common. My problem are with the public officials that allowed this to happen.
Auto dealer Norman Brayman on the Marlins' richest ever Major League Baseball contract signed this week. Finally, on the roundup, Book Fair, WLRN. For weeks, you wrote, you emailed, you tweeted, you posted, you even snail mailed 6-word stories to us. WLRN and the Miami Book Fair International collected them, and we celebrated this week at the Swamp with WLRN's Alicia Zuckerman.
Introduce yourself to the audience.
My name is Dana. I was from Pennsylvania, and I moved here when I was 10 years old to Homestead, actually.
And what's your 6-word story?
We don't belong, but we stay.
I'm so curious. What's the story behind that story?
Well, when I lived in Pennsylvania, I didn't belong, and I didn't stay. I was Hispanic, and I didn't live in a Hispanic community. And when I moved here, I was still Hispanic, but there were other people besides Hispanics and besides white and besides black and from Europe and all these different places. And so Miami isn't just Miami. It's a group of people from everywhere. And none of us are actually from here. We stay here.
Thank you so much.
WLRN's Alicia Zuckerman celebrating with six word stories and the Miami Book Fair International this week at the Book Fair. Well, we're glad you're here, and that'll do it for the Florida Roundup. Thanks to the callers, the tweeters, the posters. Florida Roundup produced by Alicia Zuckerman and Julia Duba. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Our executive producer is Peter J. Merritt, and our technical supervisor is Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is next with the review of the 13th annual Miami Short Film Festival. We're back on Monday morning for the Sunshine Economy, the business of big events. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. You.